Владимир Путин отправил в отставку многолетнего
руководителя Забайкальского района. Массового исхода единороссов из Думы не предвидится.
Дума. Избиратели несколько последних дней наблюдали за исходом депутатов из парламента.
Газета «Ведомости» сегодня написала о том, что, возможно, еще шесть представителей.
Свежая серия антимедведевского сериала. В главной роли Владимир Путин. Приглашенная звезда Игорь Сечин.
Is it the winds of change or just changing political winds? Three members of the State Duma resigned last week amid allegations that they owned undeclared property abroad, and the Russian media is rife with speculation that more could be on the way out soon. Meanwhile, Federation Council Speaker Valentina Matvienko says the resignation virus infecting the Duma could soon spread to the upper house as well. The exodus occurs as the Kremlin is putting increased pressure on officials to repatriate their foreign assets. It's tempting to dismiss all this as mere window dressing, a lame attempt by the Kremlin to pretend to care about corruption amid rising public discontent. And while that is certainly part of what is happening, something deeper than just a Potemkin purge also appears to be going on. An increasing number of Kremlin watchers are convinced that the resignations are but a warm-up for something bigger, that President Vladimir Putin is preparing a wholesale restructuring of Russia's existing political arrangements. In practice, this could mean anything from a minor government shakeup to early Duma elections and a general purge of the elite. The looming Putin reset. Is it real? What's behind it? How far will it go? And what are the risks? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me here in Prague is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
And on the Skype line from Brussels is someone new to the podcast. Andras Totsifra is a political risk consultant specializing in Russia and author of the blog No Yardstick. Welcome to the podcast, Andras.
Thank you for having me.
Andras, let's start with you. The idea that a reset is coming has been promoted by A-list analysts like Yevgeny Minchenko and Olga Krishnovskaya and others. The basic argument, and I'm of course simplifying here for the sake of time, is that given the current discontent with the regime among the urban professional class, the divisions within the elite's out of balance and is very vulnerable to challenge right now. And given all this, the status quo is unsustainable and needs to be changed. I'll put it real simply. Do you see a reset coming? And if so, how extensive of one do you see?
Well, first of all, I agree with the diagnosis. The urban class is clearly disappointed. And in the past couple of months, I think you also mentioned here in the podcast that Putin is increasingly playing to some sort of Russia B. The more uneducated rural part of the Russian population. But I don't think that this in itself must bring with itself a wholesale restructuring of the elite. I'll tell you why. I guess that every moment of change has its own limits. Russians got annoyed by the castling in 2011, right? And they got even more annoyed by the subsequent unveiling or crumbling of this fake state. But however disappointed they are, these changes cannot lead to an endless steady decrease in the popular support for the government. There needs to be something else happening, and something, another moment of scandal, another change of another kind. At the present stage, Putin has still a majority of Russians behind him. As for the thing that started it all, the recent corruption scandals and how effective the repatriation of the assets can be, I think it depends on how much the elite is ready to play along Putin's rules. This is surely an important matter to Putin. If not for the sake of a complete restructuring of the elite, but for the sake of economic matters as well. So there has to be some sort of compromise here, I guess, with the elite, between the elite and Putin.
You mentioned that that this, maybe given that his rating is not going to continue to fall, maybe that's the case. He still has a bare majority. But there's another element here, and I want to go to Kirill on this. I mean, the elite's out of balance right now. I mean, this is, Minchenko's pointed this out. Krishnovskaya and others have pointed this out. The elite's kind of out of balance right now. It's the old tandem arrangement is clearly in its death throes. There isn't a tandem. tandem anymore. Medvedev's clout seems to diminish by the day. There's this division between the technocratic and Siloviki wing of the elites. You see this in the ongoing battle between Sechin and Dvorkovich right now. Kirill, given the lack of balance in the elite right now, is a reset necessary? Because a lot of people seem to think it's coming.
Definitely, we see a very interesting and serious changes in the, you know, nature of the regime itself. And these changes are the result of several things. Of course, part of the Russian elite, or maybe almost all Russian elite, is a little bit scared by the latest moves by Putin and his inner circle. But let's try to analyze the initial cause of all this process and the mechanism of this process. Who was irritated firstly? That was elite, urban class, or regime itself. That is very interesting.
All of them at once, I would argue.
So it couldn't be, because we don't live in Platonic archetype philosophy. I think the initial cause of all these processes was that Putin himself and his aides, they lost their sense of reality in the second part of 2011. They thought that they are absolutely secure in a very secure situation, and that was the initial move that led then on after all this months to protests, and then to the protests of 2012 was the reaction to this move.
So we may not be in a Platonic ideal state, but we are in a state of kind of almost like Greek tragedy.
Absolutely.
Because hubris was one of the
in some sense, if you go on our conversation about Greek tragedy, Putin's regime was doomed to make these wrong moves initially, because Putin didn't have any choice, real choice, in 2011. He had to stay, and he tried to stay, and he's still staying now as a head of a state. And that is his main political aim, and that is, his only political ideology. And doing this, he's trying to, to be based on various, parts of the society. During the previous period, he tried to establish the regime on partly on the elite, partly on the urban class itself, with the help of Surkov, Pavlovsky, and all this political technology. And so after he failed to do this, he tried to find something new, and he thought, or his experts and aides decided that they found so-called Ural Wagon Marsh ordinary people. But ordinary people, they don't exist as a term, as a class, in modern Russia.
Now, but do you agree with Minchenko, whose the title of his last Politburo 2.0 report was "The Elite on the Eve of the Reset"? I'm shortening the title a little bit because it was a lot longer than that, but that's the gist of it. Khrushchevskaya, in an interview with Gazeta Rus, said a wholesale reset is coming, and that this move about the foreign property is just the beginning of something that's going to be much larger. That we're going to see possibly the government dismissed. We're going to see possibly early Duma elections. Do you see these things coming?
I think that's true, but Putin himself and his, Politburo, they have to be very careful with all this process, because if they try to reset or reload or to produce a new elite in Russia, nationally oriented, with the assets inside the country, and so and so and so on, these things are very irritative for so-called former elite, and this former elite includes all this old KGB cadre and so on, and that is very dangerous.
Well, I don't
for
think
him.
There's going to be a wholesale replacement. I think there's going to be, what Minchenko and others seem to be arguing is that there's going to be a partial replacement The key player, I don't see Sechin going anytime soon, for example, right? I don't see Sergei Ivanov leaving anytime soon. And that this repatriation of assets is going to be very selective.
I think that irritation is it's a term from the field of psychology. Rhetoric could be more irritative than real moves. Mm-hmm. And I think that these things could be very irritative or annoying for part of the modern Russian elite, because to listen all these, you know, talks about nationalization and so on, and all this anti-Western rhetoric, it's very annoying for them because they live outside
mm-hmm.
Russia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is very dangerous.
Now, one, I want to stick on this theme of the repatriation before we move on to the other things, because my basic question is, can this campaign work in practice? I mean, much of Russia's wealth is indeed parked abroad. It's not just a few Duma deputies. Most of Russia's wealth is parked abroad for a very simple reason. It's seen as safe there. Capital flight was over $50 billion in 2012. According to some statistics that surprised me that I just read, 9 out of 10 transactions made by large Russian corporations are made under foreign law. There are 40,000 shell companies connected alone in Cyprus alone connected with Russia. I guess I'll go to you, Andras. Is it even possible to renationalize the elite?
Selectively, I guess it can be implemented, of course, but whether it can be effective, well, given the numbers you've just given us, I doubt it. But there is a very interesting side of this debate about the amount of assets, the amount of money illegally parked abroad. It was the outgoing president of the chairman of the central bank, Sergei Ignatiev, who last week drew attention to the fact that $49 billion, which is a huge amount of money, is illegally transferred abroad from Russia. He also claimed that a large part of this money was connected to a single group. And by this, he probably meant people in the secret services or in the state apparatus. I cannot really imagine any other powerful group in Russia who
with access to that kind of money, yeah,
smuggle out this amount of money. And the following day, Alexander Bastrykin, the chairman of the investigative committee, suggested to create a financial police that would oversee these illegal depatriations. This wasn't the first time that Bastrykin suggested this. I guess he suggested something similar last year, but this time he made it clear that he wanted a separate body which probably would be staffed with his associates. So there is clearly a very staunch fight over who would be in charge of that institution that would in the future selectively apply this law. I think this is also in connection with the debates about the new head of the central bank. Putin is due to name the successor of Sergei Ignatiev soon. And first, Alexei Ulyukayev, Ignatiev's deputy, was seemed to be a successor. But now there is Sergei Glazyev, a conservative economist, in the picture. And that reflects also on this debate on who would oversee this potentially very powerful instrument.
So basically, to do this, you're going to have to use some coercive measures in order to force officials to repatriate their assets. The reasoning behind this whole drive, from my reading, there's three things basically. One is to kind of co-opt the anti-corruption agenda. Two is a reaction to the Magnitsky bill in the U.S. Congress, where a lot of attention on that was on the visa ban. But the more important part of that law, in my opinion, is the freezing of assets of officials, which makes a lot of Russian officials vulnerable to leverage from the West. And Putin would very much like to remove that leverage. The third is basically the realization on the part of the collective Putin that those who have assets abroad and property in Miami and London and elsewhere might not be terribly loyal to the Russian state if push did indeed come to shove. So there's these three motivations behind that. So Putin's trying to create a new contract with the elite now. And, you know, the old contract, the elite, was pretty simple. You give the Kremlin loyalty, you can line your pockets and park your money wherever the hell you want. The law didn't apply to you. This new contract, it's not quite clear what is going to be given in return for loyalty here. It's not sure clear where the carrot is. It's clear where the stick is, right? But it's not clear where the carrot is. And my question, I guess I'll go to Kirill with this, is if indeed they try to create this new social contract with the elite, replacing the old one of you give Putin loyalty and you get to do basically whatever you want otherwise, isn't this going to be divisive? The new policy is not exactly being met with enthusiasm. It's been opposed by Medvedev, Surkov, Matvienko, Naryshkin. Putin was forced to water down the original law that he sent to the Duma. And it's going to be applied selectively anyway. So what's the point? Does it really meet all these goals if it's applied selectively? If the most important people can continue to park their money abroad, then what the hell's the point? So Kirill, is this divisive if it's applied in full, and is it irrelevant if it's applied selectively? What do you see here?
This new contract with the elite must be a new contract, the new contract with the new elite. Mm-hmm. It couldn't exist with the old one, because the old elite, or, you know, recent...
Now, when we talk about the elite here, excuse me for interrupting here, we're not talking about the upper echelons of the collective Putin, of course. We're not talking about the Politburo. We're not talking about the executive committee of the deep state, because like I said, Sechin's not going anywhere. Sergei Ivanov is not going...
We're speaking
of the broader, broader bureaucracy.
Yes, okay. I'm not speaking about Sechin, so it's a new... so on, yes. But that must be a new elite, which is, you know, this Marxist term from the, you know, 1930s, maybe, национальная буржуазия, national
bourgeoisie. The national bourgeoisie,
yes.
Yeah.
He's not trying to make this new social circle or social, you know, class as a national bourgeoisie, but he is trying to use the term and several features of this social, you know, historical social term to his new political rhetoric. Mm-hmm. So he is trying to be, you know, in some sense, Kemal Atatürk or something like this, mm-hmm. to establish a new bourgeois class. Mm-hmm. It's not about the lower classes in Russia. All of them, it's very interesting, but that all of them, Russian, regime and Russian opposition, they totally forgot about lower classes in Russia. They're fighting for the interest or some for sympathy of the upper classes. A creative class, urban class, you can name it whatever. But anyway, they are trying to depend on these higher classes. We can call it elite or, you know, creative class or something like that, bourgeoisie. But anyway, they trying to seek the sympathy from them. Instead of seeking sympathy from recent bourgeoisie in Russia, in Marxist terms, of course, Putin trying to speak about, producing or making some new bourgeoisie nationally, thinking and so on.
Let me see if I can, correct me if I'm wrong, because what I hear you saying here, and we're going to talk about in the later half of the podcast, we're going to talk about the ideology Putin's slapping on top of all of this, because there's an ideological reset afoot as well. But what he's trying to do is to refashion the broader elite. To put it in Soviet terms, it's almost like party, what would have been party members almost,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If the upper elite is the Politburo and the broader elite is the Central Committee, it's almost like party members. He's trying to refashion that. But the rhetoric is what appeals to the lower classes. I mean, all of this nationalism and fundamentalism that we're going to talk about later in the podcast is appealing to create a majority in society writ large. And there seems to be a contradiction. The elite doesn't like what it's going to have to do now. Bring its money home, not flaunt its wealth, not act so corruptly. So the contract he's trying to create with society.
I'm fully
is in contradiction with the contract, the new contract he's trying to create with the elite. Does that make sense? And do you see what the problem seems to be right now?
This brand new Putin is trying to appeal to lower classes with all this nationalist rhetoric and rubbish and so on. But at the same time, there are no any hints of the idea of social equality or something.
No, of course not.
So that's why he failed once more.
But that what is, he is doing is he's trying to make a show of reining in the broader elite in this whole repatriation of
he cannot use the same words when he's appealing to, you know, bourgeoisie in Moscow and to so-called ordinary people in, you know, Perm or Yekaterinburg.
But there's a contradiction here.
Yes.
There's a fundamental contradiction here.
He cannot invent a new language. Mm-hmm. And that is the problem. And the new language can
he's
be...
tried.
Yes. The new language can be established only on, you know, some ideological basis.
Right.
And that is,
and we're
going
to get to that in the latter half pretty soon. And the other issue I'd want to touch on here is Putin shooting himself in the foot? Now you're saying he does have to create a new contract with almost a new broader elite, right? His main selling point is that he could protect the wealth and privilege of the existing elite. And now, in what he's doing, is he risking a rebellion among his own ranks?
The situation is very dangerous for him, I think so.
He
must be very careful because you're absolutely right. There is a contradiction between the idea of, saving or conserving the situation with property and money and whatever in Russia, and at the same time the rhetoric of nationalism and in some sense Soviet rhetoric. That is very dangerous because no one in the end could just trust him.
What do you think, Andras? Is Putin treading a dangerous path here?
First of all, I have to say that I completely agree with Kirill on that Putin is in a very dangerous state. I think Putin tries to keep the elite busy with fighting among themselves instead of fighting him or his ideas or questioning his supremacy. By now, he seems to be successful in this, to me at least. There is another process that seems to be surfacing in the past couple of months. It is what I called on my blog a compromise bubble. A majority of these corruption cases that have been made public in the past months, years old, and they had been in the drawers for some time. And some place at some time, a drawer might be opened with a compromise with Putin's name on it. We can't know, because in the past couple of years, a new type of elite, a new type of technocrats, liberals, have gained access to administrative resources through which they could access information about senior politicians. And
do you mean the younger part of the younger elite that came in during Medvedev's presidency?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Not only that part that came in during Medvedev's presidency, I also mean Yuri Chaika, the prosecutor general, or I mean Sergei Ignatiev, who came in 2002 as mm-hmm. the chairman of the central bank, but who's clearly stands closer to the liberal part of the elite than to the Siloviki, for example. They might have compromising material. And this is, I guess, the most dangerous thing that is happening around Putin right now. He cannot control the releasing of compromise. Even if he seals a new deal with the elite, it might get out of control every moment.
So this could indeed get very dangerous for Putin, because I think you're correct. A lot of the younger elite that came in with Medvedev are still there largely. They haven't been purged. I mean, part of the idea behind this might be, on Putin's part, to get rid of a lot of these people because they could be a threat. They could be a threat to him.
Yes, you mentioned the Minchenko report. The Minchenko report had a very important part about this de-Medvedevization. It's practically said that Medvedev and the circles behind or around Medvedev had gained a lot of influence during the past years. And what's happening now effectively is that Putin is trying to recreate a balance within the elite, and he still feels that Medvedev and the liberals have too much influence at some parts. You can see these battles waging with the central bank, or between the prosecution and the investigative committee, or in energy policy between Dvorkovic and Sechin. And Minchenko
between
also
Konovalov and the Duma, too. I mean, you see
exactly.
It,
yeah. And Minchenko basically said that whenever Putin thinks that the balance has been reestablished, this purging of Medvedev and his circles will be stopped. The big question is, of course, whether this point comes when Medvedev is dismissed or before. But I think there are sacrifices to be made.
Now, when we talk of this reset, and I want to get briefly both of your opinion on where, because there's a number of levels this reset could go to, from nothing to a minor government shakeup. One of the possibilities Minchenko mentions is the Medvedev being kept in as prime minister, but having very strong deputy prime ministers that are they're all going to be Putin men. That's one variant. Another variant is a wholesale dismissal of the government and a replacement of Medvedev with either a technical prime minister or a prime minister slash successor. And then you have the radical variant of the dissolving of the Duma, new elections, new government, complete purge. Kirill, which of these do you think is the more likely? I know you're not a fortune teller, but which of these does your intellect lead you to believe is the most likely scenario? I anticipated you there. I knew what you were going to say.
if I could say from the position of, you know, giving some advice to Putin, mm-hmm. I can give him advice not to invent a new elite, just to keep a recent elite divided. Because he is very skillful in administrative games. He is very skillful in some shade.
He's lost his mojo a little bit, yes, in the administrative games, though, yes, lately. He's not as good as he used to be.
Anyway, he is a very bad propagandist. He is a very bad public figure at all. Not, fishing somewhere half naked and so on, but... To speak on the, you know, rallies and so on, he's very bad in all these things, and he couldn't be a new Mussolini and so on if he's an empty suit
without his image makers crafting it, and he seems to have lost his best image makers.
But moreover, he is by nature,
because he was an effective public politician in the first part of his part of his rule.
Yes, but in some limitations. That was a game with a very strong limitation. He never spoke, directly to people. Mm-hmm. All these press conferences was, pre-recorded and skillfully edited.
So two things happened. Russia changed and became much more sophisticated in terms of these things, as we've discussed on the podcast. And the other thing is he's dismissed his best image makers, Surikov, Pavlovsky, and their teams.
Situation became very sophisticated, but if he wants to confront this new sophisticated public life in Russia with the simplest measures,
right,
with corporate state and so on, and direct propaganda from his own, he will fail because he cannot do this.
So you're expecting no reset. You're expecting status quo.
My advice is to keep the recent elite divided.
What do you expect?
I think that he lost common sense.
So you think you're going to have a wholesale?
Yes, I'm not sure that these changes will be such deep and radical. But he will try to do this.
Yeah, he's going to try to do something. I'm not sure. Andres, what do you think?
I agree he's going to try to do something. As I mentioned, this doesn't really mean to be the dismissal of Medvedev. In fact, if Putin does intend to keep Medvedev as a technical prime minister, as Minchenko also alludes, he might want to break his wings. And in doing so, Medvedev has a lot of so-called buffer zone. As I mentioned, the liberals are everywhere. So if Medvedev is willing to, for example, give up Arkady Dvorkovic, I think it is much safer for everyone if the Siloviki get the energy sector, then if they let's say, get the financial police or the prosecution or even the prime ministership from the point of view of maintaining balance. And on the topic of early elections, I think this is a possibility that Putin is seriously dealing with. Today, he drafted the new law on elections in the State Duma, and that must be a prelude to dissolving the State Duma sooner or later. But if I may have some advices for Putin as Kirill had...
We all want to advise Putin, don't we?
In the circle of Putin advisors, you know.
I think he knows that the casting of this prospective new prime minister, who may or may not be appointed after an early election, is closely connected to the question of whoever succeeds him.
Unless it's a technical prime minister.
It's a technical prime minister. But Putin already has a technical prime minister if he wants it, if he can convince Medvedev to be one. And I agree with Minchenko, it is in the best
interest
of Medvedev to accept the fact that he can be nothing more, at least at the moment, than a technical prime minister.
Okay, well, in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and move from the politics to the policy. What would this reset political elite actually try to do? I'd like to remind you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service. And on the Skype line from Brussels, making his Power Vertical podcast debut, is Andras Totsifra, a political risk consultant specializing in Russia and author of the blog No Yardstick. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
Today, there is an exceptional need for the deepening of cooperation and partnership between the state and the traditional religions. While, of course, we should preserve the secular nature of our state and not allow the church to become a state institution, we must get away from the vulgar, primitive understanding of secularism.
That, of course, was Vladimir Putin addressing leaders of the Russian Orthodox Church earlier this month. If you take a dose of Orthodox fundamentalism, add a dash of corporatism, a pinch of a police state control, and a portion of nationalism, according to a much-discussed article in Novaya Gazeta this week by political analyst Kirill Rogov, you have the components of a revamped Putinism. Rogov argues that while the Putin of the past may have used anti-Western rhetoric, he at the same time tried to keep Russia firmly embedded in the Western tradition and in Western institutions. The new Putin, he said, is fully abandoning the West and orienting itself on traditional Orthodox Christian values. The old Putin, he argues, believed in the free market, while the new Putin is more of a statist and believes in corporatism. The old Putin relied on the support of the emerging urban middle class. The new Putin is oriented on the rural and working class. So if Rogov is right, an ideological reset is also now potentially in full swing. So, Kirill, let's start with you, since your first name is the same as Kirill Rogov's. Is Kirill Rogov right, Kirill Kobrin?
To some extent, I can agree with him, but I'm not sure that Putin or his inner circle has any ideological package.
And Rogov tried to put a bunch of things together and say, because each of the discrete parts of that article he's talking about are, in fact, we do see these things. We see a move towards corporatism. We see a move towards using fundamentalist rhetoric, at least rhetoric. We see police state control, I think we never didn't see, to be honest.
We never forgot about it.
It never went away. And then the nationalism, he's talking about the nationalization of the elite, what we talked about in the first half of the podcast today, repatriotization of assets. So we see all these things. You're saying they don't fit together into a coherent package. Is that
the problem is how to combine all these elements, because all this game looks like, you know, the DIY set, do it yourself.
Right.
Because, of course, we can speak endlessly about, you know, some orthodox traditions of Russian society. But speaking frankly, these traditions, they don't exist at all after 70 years.
But it's all about symbolism and the manipulation of symbols.
It's all about words. But
and symbols.
Yes, but ideology has to have some connections with so-called reality. You cannot, appeal to some traditional or modern or whatever values if these values, they even just don't exist in the society. And I can claim that all these things, they don't exist in Russian society. You cannot be traditionalist in the society without any traditions after all these disastrous Soviet and post-Soviet years. You couldn't be nationalist in the multinational country, and of course I can understand that Putin trying to use the word nation as a political nation, not Ruski, but Россияне, Russians as a political nation. But no one understands him in this in Russia.
No, and no one really understood Yeltsin except for the urban intelligentsia.
Yes,
when he would use
About this corporate state, of course, but of course he can endlessly speak about, good examples of Mussolini rule, like Silvio Berlusconi, by the way, his friend told several weeks ago. But you cannot make or construct this corporate state in the modern Russia, because you have to have just industry, for instance.
Right, industry that's producing something outside of the energy sector,
and so on. So step by step, we see that every point of this every elements of this DIY set, they just don't exist.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, if you look at, and I actually went through them one by one, and if you look at the fundamentalism, the reliance on traditional values, or whatever you want to call it, like we discussed last week, the Pussy Riot case shows how divisive this is. You are not going to build a majority on that. You're going to get that side of society on that, but you're not going to build the kind of majority a leader like Putin has to have. An approval rating of 50 some odd percent is fine if you're Barack Obama, right? It's fine if you're the president of France or the prime minister of Great Britain. But if you want to be the kind of president that Putin's trying to be, you have to really, and the Kremlin, when Surkov was running the ideological show there, was obsessed with keeping the Putin majority, which was a big majority. It was over 70%. You're not going to get that with that. So that's a problem. The corporatism is dangerous economically, quite frankly. I don't know how you create a corporatist state in today's globalized economy.
You need a strong ideology to make this corporate state.
I mean,
state.
This whole corporate state is to keep the critical mass of the population working for these big corporations that are dependent on the state. Yeah. I mean, that's difficult to pull off. The police state, all right, what does that get you? That's coercion and nothing more. And the renationalization of the elite's assets, as we discussed earlier, if it's possible, it's going to be extremely, extremely divisive. So I think you put it very well. This is kind of an a la carte, do-it-yourself ideology. I think Rogov's on to something, but I'm not sure it all fits together. Andras, what do you think?
I agree. I'm very skeptical about this ideology of Putin in the making. First of all, because I agree with Kirill, there is no such thing as an ordinary citizen, and the Russian society is more and more divided. If you see what desirable changes mean to different segments of the population, to some it means a new president, to some it means gay rights, to some it means market freedom, to some it means only a less corrupt governor or even a refreshment of cadres within United Russia. They are similarly divided on these values, these abstract values that Putin is trying to promote. This is, of course, an obstacle also for Putin, but also for the opposition. And I think last week Kirill spoke about how Sergei Udaltsev has been unable to transmit a positive message. I guess there is a large part of the population who would need this positive message, because right now they don't have anything or anyone except for Putin. This is the only thing why Putin still has this relative majority, that others cannot come up with anything else. And Putin himself cannot come up with anything new. He's trying to do something new with old cadres. It's not going to happen. And as for corporatism and how the economy is supposed to go on, let me once again link back to the debate about the central bank. I think this reflects a critical juncture in the reflections about the future of the Russian state, or the role of the state in Russian economy. Basically, the elite has to decide whether they think they should accommodate Russian citizens with monetary easing and everything else. This implies like a stronger role of the state in the economy, bigger handouts and so on. Even if this means that they cannot do this later when the situation gets really bad in case of a new wave of the economic crisis. Or if they keep the real economy in this present state and risk that citizens will turn against them because it stays in the present state and it doesn't get any better. So it's not about ideology, it's about pragmatism. Putin has always been a pragmatist. Even when he started his first presidential term, he had already been the Putin who was the advocate of national champions, but he was also a friend of free markets. And I think today it is less of an ideology than something pragmatic.
Now, I mean, my take on this, and it comes back to discussions we've had in the last several podcasts, we seem to keep coming back to this same theme. I mean, what Rogov describes in this article, like I said, is something that's not going to get a majority. It's going to get roughly half, maybe a little less, maybe a little bit more, depending on the political mood of the moment, half the society. And you have the other half that wants a very different kind of Russia. This is again, it reflects the differentiation of society. It reflects that society is becoming increasingly sophisticated politically. It reflects, as Kirill, you said a number of times, a movement towards something more normal politics. The problem is that just one side has the power right now. And the side that represents the other side doesn't. And that's a socially explosive
and dangerous,
situation.
Sorry for interrupting you. The most dangerous thing is that in the times of Surkov, or such a legendary times of Surkov as a top ideologist.
We got to get Surkov on the podcast.
Yes.
I'd love to have him.
He tried to seek support for Putin's regime in various social groups of Russian society.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't depend on
one particular. He was very clever this way, yes.
And now this attitude changed dramatically. New ideologists or, you know, new political experts or polit-technologists and so on of Putin, they tried to establish this support from one particular social class.
Yeah.
And that is very dangerous because that could, you know, I don't want to be a prophet and so on, but that could be a cause for a real civil war. Because if just one social class, just one social, particular social class is supporting this regime, that
which is from an entirely different social class.
Yes, you know, yes. I mean, so we have 2-3-4 Russias with 2-3-4 political regimes.
This points to the contradiction I noted in the first half, where you have a regime that is serving one social class, which is the broader elite, the national bourgeoisie, as you so aptly put it, Kirill. But while appealing with using an ideology to appeal to a completely different social class that is not reaping the benefits of this at all. And it's something when you have a situation like that, something and the urban middle class feels completely left out. And that is the growing class.
Yeah.
That's the growing class. So we have an extremely, extremely explosive situation right now. I don't know if it's going to go. Civil war is a very, very, very big term. I mean, metaphorically speaking, we're headed for a
mild civil war in some sense, peaceful civil war.
But it's certainly something has to give pretty soon. I think one thing I said at the outset, what I agree with most of these analysts are saying, is that the status quo as it stands cannot really continue much longer. The tensions within the elite and between the elite and society are just much too great right now. I just don't see. I don't see how this continues without something giving.
All this status quo will go on just in the way of rotting of everything, the state, the society, and so on. It's the way we see on several Latin American examples.
Right.
We can predict even this
Last week we finished on a positive note. It doesn't appear we're going to be doing that this week, although I would like to try, but I can't. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me here in Prague has been my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service. And on the Skype line from Brussels has been Andras Totsifra, a political risk consultant specializing in Russia and author of the blog No Yardstick. Thanks for the great discussion, guys.
My pleasure.
My pleasure.
I'd also like to thank our superb producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and most definitely should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.